Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
In our always absorbing, never-ending examination of life, faith and culture here on Open House, tonight we look at a highly significant and especially enduring icon of Aussie culture. It has charted 80 years of Australian life, telling countless numbers of stories and shaping much about the character of women in particular. The Australian Women's Weekly is celebrating 8 decades of publishing. That's an amazing achievement in and of itself. It remains the magazine of highest circulation in the country. The October edition is a celebration of the milestone and reflecting on some of the most memorable, noteworthy, even controversial covers. Over the last 4 years, Helen McCabe has been the editor-in-chief of the Australian Women's Weekly, and she's really energised it in a number of significant ways. Helen is a great friend of mine of long standing, because neither of us are old, and she's a great friend of Open House. Welcome back, Helen.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for your time. How and why do you think the Weekly has been so enduring, Helen?
I think it's had an incredible relationship with its reader, and that's all Australian women. And it always promises to be fair and accurate and above the fray to some extent, and always correct, like it's always right. I mean, we get, I mean, that's a generalisation. We do get things wrong, of course, but mostly if it's in the Weekly, you can believe it. And so that kind of integrity has been maintained right across the span of the decades, and I'm indebted to the other 16 editors who have had carriage of this magazine for making sure that that is the one element that stands no matter what we've done, whether we've, and we have done some nuts things and we have had some editors try and do different bits and pieces with the title, but mostly it just has immense integrity and it's always been very relevant to the lives of Australian women.
So when you took it over 4 years ago, how daunting was that prospect?
Look, I don't think I understood it at the time. I've talked about this a bit in recent times. I don't think I fully got it. I was very newspaper-focused, very hard news-focused. One of the fellow publishers said to me the other day, I've watched you, he said, and I think it took you about 12 months before you sort of sat behind that desk and went, heck, I'm the editor of Australian Women's Weekly. I didn't really get the magnitude of it, and, you know, I think it really sort of dawns on you when you do the 80th birthday, the history of it, and you go back and produce all the great stories and you look at where it's come. So it's a job that I'm very much still learning and still very much growing into, I think.
Take us back 80 years. What did it set out to do and be, and paint us a picture of what that magazine was like then?
Well, it started under Sir Frank Packer as a newspaper, so a classic kind of broadsheet newspaper in 1933, and it was for women. So Frank had an idea that women were not getting the information that they were interested in, and so he produced this paper, and it was sold out by lunchtime. Which, you know, that's rare these days, yes, if anything sells out by lunchtime. Yeah. That was its primary role. And it's interesting when I think about where we're at now, 80 years on, and our online venture. I think there's still enormous scope for the Weekly to be a daily, hourly, you know, minute-by-minute source of information for women, you know, by women in that mold. And to some extent, that's the future of the magazine. We're going to go back to the past of the magazine and produce that kind of, those kind of stories. So, for example, if you were doing Grand Final Week, I would present in the Weekly, on the Weekly website, a whole range of stories that would be quite different from the ones you'll see in the newspapers, which in this country I think are still very masculine. And there is, yes, enormous scope for us. And that's the joy of the Weekly, is that the genesis around news and telling stories. So on that first page, I think it's really worth looking at, it had two major pieces, one about fashion, what women were wearing of the at that particular time, and the other story was about equal rights for women. So you had that interesting mix, which was from being lifestyle orientated, so giving women beauty and fashion and cooking and recipe advice, while also being a trailblazer for women's issues. And that's still what we're doing.
When you go back to 1933, look at the amount of change in Australia, in the world. How did the magazine keep pace with it, even to the extent of sometimes setting agendas, sometimes defining what it is to be an Australian woman?
Yes, it did set the agendas, and the Weekly had war correspondents, for example. It sent women to war and covered the what women were doing on the front line. And then it kind of catalogued what that meant for women. They were required and they could do the jobs, and then when they came home, they found it difficult to slot back into normal lives, and equally for the women in the home with their husbands away. So the magazine covers that whole development of you know, of working women, and it does it with an inherent conservatism, however. You know, it says this movement is happening and you might be involved in it, but it also had serious concerns for what that meant for raising families and for children. And I think the magazine still walks that very delicate line between being on the forefront of the issues that affect women and the developments in that area, whilst acknowledging that we are very much about family and about children. We're still very fascinated by babies and children growing up and what that means for your family and how many children you've had and whether you can or can't get pregnant and what age you have your children and how many marriages you have. So it still has an inherent conservatism, which I think is about family life, while still acknowledging that the lives of women are changing.
Let me throw a few kind of bullet point questions at you about your time and also that of the weekly more broadly. Highest selling edition?
In my time, that's a very easy question to answer. It was the royal wedding to yes. Prince William and Catherine Middleton. And that illustrated to me that magazines still have enormous life in them. You know, as I think something like 750,000 copies of that magazine sold. We don't normally give out individual sales figures, so that's an unusual thing for me to do, but it gives you an indication of the strength of that couple and that story. Overall, I think, and it's very hard because you're not comparing apples and apples. We were a weekly for a long time and we changed to a monthly in the 1980s, but we were selling over 1 million copies at one stage. But in the Diana years were enormous, so probably yes. The Diana wedding to Prince Charles, and then the couple of the Testino covers when, you know, beautiful images of Bayer Mario Testino with the boys would have been the biggest. Before I got here, huge sales on Magda Sabansky. The first cover we did with her under Robin Foister sold enormous amounts, and that was really about Magda's weight loss. So this still gives you an indication, a much loved figure yes. and weight loss will yes. still sell a magazine.
Yeah.
And then a Christmas issue is probably, you know, every year we sell a lot of magazines around Christmas, and that again is about family.
Most controversial. You've had a number of those, haven't you?
Yes. I have, and I do think it's better to be talked about than not at all, but I do equally get a bit anxious every time I'm about to do one of these things. But Deborah Hutton on the cover, a 50-year-old woman, she turned 50 that year naked on the cover 2 years ago. Extraordinary reaction to that. Kind of crazy to do on a conservative, essentially a conservative magazine. Julia Gillard in 2010, just prior to the federal election being called, when she'd taken over from Kevin Rudd. That was very controversial, yes. whether you should put a political figure on the cover. I justified it on the grounds of history. This magazine could not put the first female prime minister on the cover. Julia Gillard again, knitting prior to the more recent election in which she lost the job just as we came on the stands. And some thought it was a puff piece giving her a free kick. Some thought it was disgraceful treatment of her. And others were completely bemused why there'd be any fuss about it at all, because it's perfectly logical for a woman to want to knit. I copped the full gamut of criticism on that one.
Your favourite story or cover or magazine, what would you say?
My favourite magazine is the one that I've just produced for the 80th birthday. I'm immensely proud of that. But there's one story this year that is a little known story that I have to tell you because I completely love it, and it's about a woman in Canberra who married for the second time the love of her life. They were married for something like 30 years. He had a stroke and after some time they pulled the life support, and it took her a year to get over. He was a fabulous husband. They were very tightly knit, and he would write her love letters and poems and send her flowers on every possible anniversary. So 12 months on, she had a big family dinner and promised her family that she would move on the next day, and she walked into his study that next morning and opened the doors. He was an academic. Found all these boxes, and on one of them there was a name written across it, and there was something like 800 love letters from another woman, and he'd had a 9-year affair. She says if women say that they know when their husband's having an affair, and she says that's not always the case. So it's a very confronting story. But the key to this actually is that she then writes the book and publishes all the letters from the girlfriend and his letters to the girlfriend, and they're quite explicit and they're a bit hard going.
That's an amazing story.
But it's an amazing story, and you sort of get a sense of this is one woman's revenge at her husband's infidelity. So I loved that story.
Yeah. I think you rather quickly passed over what you've got in this anniversary edition. That is a bumper and a half.
Yes, and every now and then someone mentions another story that I forget to talk about, but it's the first interview since 1974 with Prince Charles, and as I sit here, the papers in Britain are running that interview all over the place. It's been running in the newspapers for 2 or 3 days. Prince Charles, he talked to Juliette Ridden, who's an Australian Women's Weekly journalist, but she's the deputy editor, and she spent 2 days with him, some of that at Balmoral, and he talks about dancing and how he's a bit of a dancer, and that his sons, William and Harry, got the groove from him. So that's been headlines in England.
That's what he says.
That's what he says, yeah. And Princess Mary hasn't done an interview since 2005, but she hasn't done a shoot inside the palace in Copenhagen since Vogue did it 9 years ago. We went inside the palace, we went to Malaysia with her, we met her kids, we took Australian designers over, and all the clothes she's wearing in the magazine are Australian designers, and it's a terrific interview about her.
Yes, and Anna Bligh without hair.
Anna Bligh without hair. Anna Bligh, God bless her. I think this woman is quite inspirational. I'm not a Queenslander, so I wasn't in the state when she was Premier, but I've had enough dealings with her to think personally she's outstanding. And she told her story and allowed herself to be photographed without any hair at all because she's just come through her chemo treatment. Fingers crossed she's going to be okay, but it's been a very tough time for her. John Howard talks about the severity of his deafness. A little known fact that he often couldn't understand what anyone was saying
it's
to him.
Yes,
and yet he was Prime Minister for more than 10 years.
It is an amazing work. I'm interested to ask you this. What do you say to your editors and writers about how you portray the Australian woman, Helen, 80 years after the magazine was launched? What do you say to them? What's your view of today's woman?
Well, there's no one woman. We are talking to all women, so that poses challenges, actually. You have women that are very highly educated and wealthy, and you have women that are single mums and on the dole reading the magazine. So there's that whole scope, and what we try to do is not pigeonhole anybody. We try to do lots of different stories that might appeal to one section, but then mix it up again and choose something that's quite different again. So young stories about young, up-and-coming Australian women, retro stories about, you know, Jackie Kennedy alongside of a Helen Mirren cover and a Megan Gale cover. So we keep it very broad. But I also think we have to be kind of realistic about who the average woman is and not pitch our beauty and our fashion and our food and our culture stuff too high. Like, we keep our price points lower. We try to imagine that not everyone is wanting to spend vast amounts of money on the sorts of things that other magazines tend to feature. So we do try to pitch quite differently from some other magazines. But we're in a very competitive environment, because you can buy a whole food magazine or you can buy a whole fashion magazine. Yep. So we have to be the best at all of those categories. It is an interesting question, and I'm not sure you get it right every month, but I hope that we get it right over a 12-month span.
Yeah. I'm interested in the rarefied world that you dwell as a media boss, how you stay in touch with the average Aussie woman, who they are, what they think, what's going on in their lives. How do you stay in touch?
I live in the inner city. I don't drive. I'm well paid. I'm aware that I live quite a different life. I don't have children, so I'm aware I have quite a different life from a lot of my readers. But what I do is I come from a country town in South Australia. I travel back home. I have 9 nieces and nephews, a lot. I get out and about at events. We've travelled all over Australia going to the agricultural shows and meeting women. I've hosted high teas all over Australia, so I talk to the readers a lot. There's a Westfield shopping centre in West Lakes in Adelaide that I imagine. I'm there a lot when I'm home. I imagine that woman wandering around getting their bread from Baker's Delight and picking up their meat and think, what does she want to read this month versus what my contemporaries in media in Sydney might want to read. I'm very, very focused on not doing what is likely to be of interest to Australian media, but what is more likely to be of interest to everyday Australian women. I don't have paid television. Drives Angelo Frangopoulos at Sky News and your former boss crazy. I watch reality TV a lot.
Okay.
And I watch what normal people watch on television. It is a bit of a challenge.
Yes.
I don't pretend to be really living their lives, but I give a lot of thought to what their lives are like.
I actually think it shows. And congratulations
to
all your colleagues over those 80 years and to you especially over the last four. Helen McCabe, thank you so much indeed for joining us again on Open House.
Lee Hatcher, it's always good to talk to you.
So kind. See you soon.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.